On this edition of Conversations, we take a look at at-risk kids. What makes a child at risk for failure in school? And what does that risk mean for the young person, for the family, for the school, and for the community? At-risk kids on Conversations. We'll be talking with Professor Bill Parrott. His latest book is called Hope at Last for At-Risk Youth. It's an optimistic title. Bill, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Susan.
I want to start not now, but back at the turn of the century, because there are a couple of statistics in the early chapters of Hope at Last that made me keep going back to this particular paragraph. At the turn of the century, 90% of school-age kids didn't finish school. Midway through the century, in the 1950s, roughly 50% failed to complete school. In this day and age, we'd be frantic. In those days and ages, was that something that was seen as distressing, normal, not anything of note? What do you think?
Well, I wasn't there during those years, but I know from family members of my own, as well as many, many conversations with other people, that at the turn of the century, if you finished school, it was a kind of an exclusive opportunity. A lot of people didn't have that opportunity. There were more important things to do. Through the early 1900s and even up through the war years, a high school degree, a high school diploma, was not something that one had to have to ensure a successful life. There were jobs in the factories, in the fields, in the forests, upon which one could build a very good life, could buy a home, send the kids to school, acquire many possessions, live well. Those days have diminished considerably since the era of the 1950s, and certainly were in the early period, the turn of the century, most people didn't see the need, didn't need to go to school, didn't need to finish school. There were better things to do.
We've got a disturbing to our time dropout rate now. Do you think we also have a residual from that earlier sensibility that if a person, probably especially a male, has energy and savvy and street smarts and is willing to put shoulder to the wheel, that that person can do fine without an education? Or have we changed our minds about the importance of an education?
Well, the reality is you can't do fine without an education today. Whether or not in the minds of some of our young folks today they believe they can, the feeling of many high school and middle school level kids is one of invincibility. And I don't know myself if that drives a conscious decision to leave school or to not do well in school, but I think that at a very short, within a very short period of time after school, kids will realize that they have eliminated an entire spectrum of opportunities by failing to receive an education in terms of the kinds of jobs that inevitably they've got to face and what they can do. I think that the times have changed in that regard, that we're not, they don't leave school knowing opportunities are there. They perhaps leave school wondering if opportunities are there, or maybe wondering if and when they'll ever have to work.
Your book says, I don't have it exactly, so I'll just throw the paraphrase at you, hopefully, that I think the sentence is something to the effect of, we're building a near-permanent underclass of kids who will probably not have jobs in their lives and will probably be dependent on social welfare systems. Is that close enough?
Well, we have been building for quite a number of years a system or an underclass very much like this of individuals in the society who have benefits and individuals in the society mm-hmm. who don't have benefits and who have been reliant very much on social service, welfare, on various forms of state assistance to make it in life. There are generations now of families who have never worked that are in existence in this country, and I hesitate to say we're building, because it's not an end that I think anyone wants to move mm-hmm. toward, but by failing to educate a substantial portion of kids in this society today, we are putting ourselves in a position of having to deal with the consequences of that. And some of those, indeed, are the social costs that come into play.
Mm-hmm. We're taking a look on this edition of Conversations at at-risk kids and their the impact of schools on them and their impact on the society. Our guest is Professor Bill Parrott. He's a professor of education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks with a long string of books and articles and essays behind him, the latest of which is the one we're talking about today. It's called Hope at Last for At-Risk Youth. This is not the hopeful end of our conversation, I think, but perhaps later we'll move towards that. One of the statistics early on in the book, and I'm trying to get these statistics to us just to establish the foundation here. One of the statistics is that 1 million students a year leave school. Are those students who are leaving permanently? Did they move to some other town? Will they come back to school at some other point? Will they go to some other kind of school? What do we know about that 1 million a year that leaves school?
We probably don't know enough. Uh-huh. We do know that they leave, and many of them do many of the things that you spoke of in terms of events in their lives. They move, they return to school sometimes, they enter other programs, they go to work, a variety of outcomes. We don't know that much about what happens to kids when they leave school. It is estimated, based on statistics nationally, that approximately 1 million kids a year leave school. It's a number that's been fairly constant over the last few years, and one that's pretty much accepted when data is compiled and reviewed nationally, given the extremely high rates in some areas of our country, particularly urban areas, mm-hmm. to the lower rates in other areas. So it's pretty much an agreed upon solid statistic that drives a lot of the concern for what we do with these kids.
One more number. In addition to that, 700,000 do graduate from school but without writing skills, mm-hmm. complex problem-solving skills, mm-hmm. full literacy. Why? I'm sorry to ask that question this way. And we've got the luxury of time to talk about some reasons why, but can you give me an image that I can...
Well, it's an equally disturbing occurrence in schools today, and that's of the phrase that's probably been used most to characterize these students is that of being functionally illiterate but yet graduating from school. If you listen to or focus on the concerns in public schools today of how many kids are getting through but yet are below level in skills, this is where the 700,000, again, that's an approximation of the number of kids that are graduating without the requisite skills. There are many issues that will come up. Some will point to the event of social promotion as being the reason, meaning kids are getting passed along without requisite skills at grade levels.
Right.
Others will speak to the lack of standards or lowered standards or different standards between schools. There are any number of reasons that individuals will, and educators and scholars will, point to and say this is why this many are getting through our schools today. In reality, this is a good estimate. We don't really know. Albert Shanker of the American Federation of Teachers believes that we truly only educate in the manner in which our system attempts to educate about 15 to 20% of our kids. That another 40 to 50% come through with a very substandard level of abilities, and that's where it's that group that the statistics come out of. Only 1 in 5 can read a bus schedule and interpret it, and only a certain number can do checking accounts and those kinds of things. There's a big proportion of kids in our schools today, in our public schools today, that do progress through and graduate, but that come out with substandard skills. The estimates, I think the 700,000 estimate is one by the Shores in their book Within Our Reach, which has attempted to look at not just the kids that are leaving school, but those that are coming through significantly ill-prepared for later life.
This, I assume you would conclude, has huge consequences for the democracy, the economy, the social fabric of our country.
Very much. And it's perhaps, if you look back over time, school reform is not, and changing schools and problems with schools, this is not new. There, you can literally document, as long as there have been schools, there have been critics and folks that have felt that the schools were not doing as well as they should or what they should be doing and so on. It's probably been until the 1970s, and many people believe it was a feature of technology, the growth of technology, the sophistication of the workplace that has created many opportunities and eliminated many opportunities for a workforce. The workforce of today can not rely on their backs and their hands to accomplish and to get jobs and to accomplish those jobs. The workforce of today increasingly needs skills of literacy, computational skills, logical thinking skills, and many of the things that come along with sophisticated jobs in the workplace. And it's business in this country, and it's the economy of this country that many feel is feeling the effects of a workforce that is being diminished in terms of its skill. David Kearns of IBM, former CEO of IBM, estimates that it will cost businesses $25 billion was his figure, over the next few years to train a workforce that we simply don't have available to us here in this country.
Bill Parrett is with us. He's been working with what we now call at-risk kids since before there was a phrase, at-risk kids. He started in the very early 1970s, beginning in 1972 as a teacher of a number of disciplines in an alternative school. Following that, he worked as the principal of another alternative school and then helped to direct an alternatives education project, an alternatives teacher education program at Indiana University, where he was a student. His bachelor's is in social studies education from Indiana University at Bloomington, his master's in alternative education, and his PhD in alternative education. So he began work in the field in 1972, graduated with his PhD in 1979, and as far as I can tell, has not stopped since. This is clearly your life's work. Bill Parrett, now professor of education specializing in this area at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We're talking about his book called Hope at Last. There have been indictments of the public schools for 10 years that I know about. You've alluded to them. Is it in large part that public school in America has not been able to keep up with a changing economy, and the changing economy has forced intellectual change upon us as well? We're just not tracking?
Well, that's certainly a part of it. There's very little connection, as you know, between public schools and the workplace. This is an area of much speculation in terms of the need for reform, and in fact many promising practices around the country focus on the transition of youth through schools into the workplace and as well as into higher education. Many have criticized the schools over the years that they primarily are attempting to prepare students for college, and in reality only a small portion of our students go to college. The rest are not able to be successful in that respect and end up in other avenues of work or training for which maybe the schools didn't do such a good job with them. So that's one area of indictment. It's certainly one that the workplace feels is most appropriately placed on the schools today.
Mm-hmm. Is that one you consider is vital, or is there another one in the back of your mind?
I think there's so many that contribute to this concern that that are indeed vital. I'd say yes, that is one that's vital. Mm-hmm. The whole arena of identifying students at risk has brought about some, I think, realization of the purpose and the effectiveness and the capability of schools. Many school people, for instance, would say it's not our position. Educators, parents, others in the community would say it's really not the position of the school to get this person ready for this particular job. In fact, if you look at the research and the work of those who have studied intently the causes of kids and the factors that place students at risk, they feel that in reality only maybe two out of five of general categories can the schools really have any impact over, that so much of the of a child's success or lack of success in schools today comes from the family, the home, and how well that student's life is connected between the school and the family.
Let's back up then and take a look at what puts a child at risk. Here's another thought from your book that this shocked me, that by the third grade you will know if a child is going to graduate from high school or not. How do you know that?
Well, it is shocking, and it was the result of a study funded by the U.S. Department of Education about 6 years ago that looked at factors of kids being at risk in early elementary grades, and they followed kids and they looked at all different levels of criteria associated with youth at that age, and came to the conclusion that if there's a collision of factors, as some refer to, at an early age, you can predict with alarming reliability what that child's success rate will be in terms of making it through school. The factors that they speak to have to do with poverty. If the child is living in poverty, and about a quarter of our kids are in this country today, if the child attends school with other poor children, other children living in poverty, if the child has been retained, held back a grade, if those factors collide in terms of the an overall, if they come together when the student is in the first, second, third grade, by the third grade, they estimate that the student's chances of graduating from high school are nearly zero at that time. Probably the startling, and this is, you may have noted this a startling aspect of this was when it hits the national news media. There was a Newsweek story 4 or 5 years ago, I think we cite that as well, that was exclaiming that the state of Indiana was using research similar to this to predict prison space needs for the future. And they were what we, as a part of this work, contacted them, and they spoke with alarming and chilling confidence that they felt by looking at second graders and third graders, achievement scores, reading scores, attendance patterns, behavior problems, that they could come up with very reliable numbers in terms of the how much they needed to either ratchet up or change their number of prison beds they were planning for. They do it. They use it. And I'm sure other states do as well. So looking at kids not succeeding in school at a very early age is happening, and it's being used by far more than just educators. How valid that is, I don't know for sure. I don't know that anyone knows for sure, but it's they're taking it very seriously.
There were clusterings of problems in talking about at-risk kids, personal pain, academic failure, and socioeconomic. So you've hit two of them at least. That if that child is impoverished and then living in a community of poverty, which really says disastrous things for whole pockets of our country, I think, then that child doesn't have much of a chance. When we're looking at personal pain and academic failure, being held back a grade would be a sign. What are some of the signs we haven't looked at for that child that puts him or her at risk by third grade?
Well, probably, again, there are. I would hesitate to guess how many have tried to come up with a matrix or a listing of risk factors. Probably the most expansive and comprehensive study started with talking to everyone from panels of experts to families, to educators, to parents, to whoever they could corral, I think, to come up with a listing of the and to check out what these people thought were serious risk factors of students. They then, this was a study conducted by Phi Delta Kappa in the late 1980s, they then developed a 45-item matrix of listings that were ranked in terms of at factors of being at risk, and they went out all over the country and tested those and then re-ranked them based on the results. A lot of the factors came in areas that you wouldn't expect. That teachers and students and parents had reported that caused a student to feel at risk. The obvious factors such as attempting suicide or a variety of health-related sexually transmitted diseases, pregnancy, a number of within the arena of health, mm-hmm. certainly would cause a student to be categorized or to become at risk of not graduating from high school. And that's, by the way, many people question, what do you mean by at risk? Isn't everyone at risk at times? Probably yes, but we're focusing on at risk of not graduating during the time period that one should through high school. Mm-hmm. Other categories, mobility was a category that came up, moving. Interesting that we don't think too much about that. Most of us have moved a lot. In fact, we've moved a lot more than our families before us. There was an interesting article about where they followed a group of kids in a school that started from K through 12, and they followed 600 and some odd kids, and found that only 83 of those kids went all the way through K through 12 school mm-hmm. in the same school district. And of those 83 that did go through, 90-some-odd% graduated from high school. They made it all the way through. Of the kids that moved once during that time, the graduation rate dropped down to 68%, I think. And of the kids that moved three times during that period of time, only 36% of them graduated. So we feel that there's definitely a correlation with mobility, which is very much a way of life in this society today. Other factors that cause kids to be at risk, a major one is the whole arena of language. And we have many, many kids in our schools today that are second, for which English is a second language, and they come with a great disadvantage in that regard into a system that expects and primarily instructs in English. Mm-hmm. And so we still have large numbers of immigrant children and others living in this country, over 100 language groups whose kids come to school, again, at disadvantage because of this. And it's very difficult for a lot of those kids to catch up.
Uh-huh. And this is at least part of, a large part of this problem is that once one or two or three factors set you back as a child, it's hard to catch up. Mm-hmm. If your reading level isn't at third grade by third mm-hmm. grade, if your English isn't good by a particular time, if you're mm-hmm. moving from Phoenix to out wherever, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, they all contribute.
Can we turn this around just a little bit, change the angle a little bit? I'm interested in how we look at kids at risk from, say, inside a school, the PTA and the administrators and the teachers and the parents and the community. It seems to me that some of the issues you've mentioned and some of the issues I've read about in the book are charged. Hmm. Minority, ethnic, immigrant, pregnancy, drugs, alcohol, poverty, all of these things have a charge in this country of one sort or another. And if you gather them in a child and call him at risk, I wonder if attitudes towards those issues make it difficult to see that child. Is that a fair question to...
Sure, yeah. Sure, it's fair, and it's probably very real in terms of the translation of those attitudes toward equal and fair treatment in schools. Countering this notion of, the notion of labeling kids or of identifying kids at risk, which many feel is very important that we do, that we help teachers understand in classrooms what types of kids they have and what the challenges and needs are of those students. The While that's important, there's a real fear that by labeling kids at risk, that you're placing a stigma on that child that's going to go a long way, a stigma beyond some that a child may carry anyway, that may never allow them to resume or catch up with other kids in schools.
Meaning you might see the disability, the weakness, but not see the excellence and the potential.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. Mm-hmm. But there are other factors as well that kids that are at risk face in schools. A simple one is, it's not a simple one, it's a disastrous one for kids, but it has to do with who they work with in classrooms. There have been numerous studies conducted that have determined that it's the new teachers, it's not always the case, but often it's new, less experienced teachers that find themselves with the kids that are the slow group kids or the beginning level, basic level classes, that as teachers stay in school and gain experience and tenure and so on, they tend to move up to the more advanced kids. They
I've
choose
done my
to do
time
that.
With the basics. Yeah.
Right. I've done my time. So the other factors that influence the kids, aside from who is going to be teaching them, are the actual classroom settings. You've got often less experienced teachers working with them. It's been determined in a number of studies that the kinds of questions that the kids are asked, the types of expectations that are held for them, the assignments that are given them, all are tend to be much more lower level in terms of the expectation of advanced thinking skill or higher level thinking skills. Lots of worksheets. It's not the rule, but it tends to happen frequently with the kids that they face this level of instruction. Some have even said quite vocally that once you're in a slow group, once you're in a low group, you never get out. And it's quite true. We can look around the schools today and you don't often find students that might begin a ninth grade year in a basic English class and work their way into an AP class. There are exceptions, but it doesn't happen often.
The book is called Hope at Last for At-Risk Youth. One of its two editors is Dr. William Parrott. He's with us on this edition of Conversations. The second editor is Dr. Robert Bass, and he's from Oregon.
Sorry.
Barr. Oh, I said Bass. I'm sorry. Dr. Robert Barr from, and am I right about the place?
He was, when we finished this, he was in at Oregon State University.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The two of them gathered all the latest research and data about at-risk youth, what works, what doesn't, what the problems are, and put it together in a book, which I found very readable. It's for professionals, but as a layperson, it's a good book. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at at-risk youth. Is that a myth, that risk for failure in school for various reasons means that a child is slow or can't learn or has what we would think of as a retardation problem? Does that equate?
Well, we certainly, and I think research supports us very much, and it's not just us, it's many people that believe these are myths that have been perpetuated in schools. Again, I hesitate to generalize because there are many schools that have put these myths like what you've spoken aside and have moved considerably beyond that. But in many places in this country today, the notion that all kids can learn is still not accepted. Some kids are viewed as being unable to learn for whatever reason, and therefore not provided opportunities. So the myths are there in schools today, as well as the how to help these kids. Some ideas still are very pervasive that just don't seem to work, mm-hmm. that are out there today.
Mm-hmm. You don't think that retention works, what is called retention, holding a student back for another year. Mm-hmm. What does that do to a student, that keeping that child in school, moving with his or her class, wouldn't accomplish or would accomplish?
Well, the retention is viewed by many as the most researched topic or issue within education.
Really?
Historically, in terms of the piles of studies that have been conducted. For years and years and years, this has been looked at as far as a solution or a strategy within the public schools. The reality is that if kids have been retained, at-risk kids, kids that have single or multiple factors that may or may not disadvantage them or put them at risk in schools, their chances of graduating are significantly lower in terms of the likelihood, if you compare them across the group of kids that have been retained, of graduating. It's a practice that is very common, that the most recent study I'm familiar with, almost half of the teachers surveyed believe in the practice and recommend its use. Mm-hmm. About a quarter of the principals felt the same way. But yet, scholars that have studied the effects, particularly on at-risk kids, unanimously will voice concern over what this does for kids at risk. Now, on the other side of the issue as well, so then the obvious, we just pass them along, right? And then hit the 700,000 or whatever the number is of kids that get through without skills. There are alternatives, and there are other methods and approaches to tracking that some schools are using quite successfully in the country today. And those emphases almost always focus on some level of accelerated catch-up that is not putting the student back into the same pool or on the same track to just continue another loop in terms of going through the third grade again. Some students, if you look at how retention happens in schools, sometimes they'll go right back into the same classroom. Well, everyone in that class is going to know that student was retained, as well as that student, as well as that teacher. So they carry something with them. They might put them in another teacher's class, but still the stigma is there. Mm. There just has not been evidence to support the use of this practice. The latest article that I'm familiar with that addressed a look at numerous studies of the effects of retention. The quote which we have in our book, I won't read, but basically it says retention as a strategy, after looking at volumes and volumes of studies, we conclude that retention as a strategy absolutely is not effective. It mm-hmm. fails as a strategy. And I tack onto that particularly for kids at risk. There have been successes with retention, no question about that. But for kids at risk, we can't make a case that it works.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at some things that do work. I mean, clearly you mm-hmm. feel this mm-hmm. is a crisis in the country, and that there are all sorts of indications that the situation's getting worse. But there are a lot of, your mm-hmm. book certainly points, and mm-hmm. the large part of your book points to a lot of bright lights, a lot of things mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. that do tend to work. The book is divided, just so people know, into sections that deal with preschool and kindergarten, say the earliest part of school, into elementary, into middle school, into high school. I noticed some very similar strategies mm-hmm. working through each. So maybe what we can do is take a look at strategies and show how they might differ, if you mm-hmm. want to, from mm-hmm. between high school and preschool or middle school and mm-hmm. the like. It seemed to me something that was clear was one-on-one individual attention to the student's needs, whether we're talking about reading or we're talking mm-hmm. about physics. This seems like an obvious mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What you call strategy. Why don't we do it, and why does it work so wonderfully?
Why don't we do it, and yeah. why does it work so wonderfully? Why don't we do it? Probably there's the obvious cost issue. Any time that the class is broken down such that a teacher has significant time to spend individually with a student, you've got to be doing something quite different or have considerable resources that typically schools don't have today. Why does it work so well? Again, for many of the obvious reasons that individual attention works in most respects. Mm. When one apprentices for a career in architecture, for instance, it's a very individual type of experience where one learns from another person. Mm-hmm. It is felt that one-on-one tutoring is probably the most effective instructional technique known to humankind historically, forever. In fact, early on, that's the way teaching took place. Was a transmittal of knowledge uh-huh. and working one-on-one. So we know intuitively how well one-on-one interaction works, particularly, again, when we look at kids at risk who perhaps are coming from families where dysfunctional families or varied kinds of situations at home where school is not a priority nor is the educational process. One-on-one attention to that process is a dramatic leap from what the child may be spending half of their life doing outside of the school, or more than half of their life. So the practice, particularly in the acquisition of early skill of reading and early understanding of the principles and becoming a reader early on, is critical to a child's success in school. And in terms of where the hope about all this is, there are, in this work that we've done, and it's really why we decided to put this effort into print, is that we now know throughout this country of thousands of examples, schools, programs, practices that are providing hope for kids, hope for a first, a second, a third grader that previously would have to suffer the consequences of maybe not learning how to read and trying to make it through school that way. We've got numerous examples now in various locations in the country where classrooms as well as entire schools have adopted new practices, many of which incorporate one-on-one tutoring for the teaching of early reading. And there are numerous programs in the country that have been designed. They're actual programs that come with research-based conclusions of if you do this is what the program will do, and you'll teach kids to read. Mm-hmm. Those are available today. A lot of them rely on one-on-one tutoring. It's a theme that does go throughout. It's a theme that's connected to me to smallness, which is another issue or condition that we find is so important oftentimes in helping students that are at risk. A smaller class setting, a smaller school setting, a closeness and an opportunity for teachers and a principal and the home life and the child to connect. The large comprehensive schools that we have, particularly the high schools, have a very difficult time enabling a process of connection between children and teachers and parents. Connections that are important to build trust and support the educative process. It's very difficult to happen, and that's the latter junior high and middle school years mm-hmm. and early high schools when a lot of the kids leave school.
They get more and more alienated as the situation gets bigger right. and more anonymous.
Right. Elementary schools are much better, far better than the later schooling years, and that has to do a lot with the maturation process of the students too, and
right.
so on.
But a good part of the emphasis, it feels to me, from Hope at Last is on prevention, starting as young as possible. So you intervene as early as preschool.
Right.
And that's to get these habits started before they
right.
break away.
Right. It's obvious, again, for most people, certainly yourself, that a child entering the first grade coming from a situation where the child has been read to, the child has been talked to, the child has been actively encouraged to investigate and explore, mm-hmm. where education is very much a part of life, where perhaps TV viewing has been monitored to in terms of the amount and what the child is watching. You put a child in a first grade seat that has been through that type of early developmental preparation, if you will, for school, and transpose that with a child who has not had those benefits and does not know an alphabet and has had very little interest or acquaintance with our simple system of literacy. You're starting two children at roughly the same age from very different perspectives, and it's no wonder that in a short period of time, I mean, a lot of kids come to school reading, mm-hmm. and a great number of kids come without even the basic fundamentals of beginning. So we've got a wide disparity. That has been helped through programs like Head Start, and a number of states have realized that even before Head Start can kick in with kids, that issues related to family literacy and helping parents and children prepare for even programs like Head Start are very important. And so some states have started, and they all have Start in the title, Great Start and Even Start, and and others that actually have provided funds and made classrooms available for and experiences for parents and kids to begin a process of becoming, of gaining literacy together.
I want to ask a question that I feel some part of our audience is already asking, and relate it to other parts of your book. Your book suggests that the school has to connect itself with social services to help kids who are having real personal problems or socioeconomic problems, mm-hmm. that teen parents of preschool children need to be getting parent education to help mm-hmm. those children be ready for school, mm-hmm. and that's part of a school's participation in the community. There are several other suggestions that link the school with the community and make the school more responsible for the social condition of the child. What I hear someone in my audience saying is, this is a bootstrap country. You've got to pull yourself up, solve your own problems. We're not socialist. It's not our job as a nation, and certainly not our job as taxpayers who support schools, to deal with people who can't even raise their own kids. Why do you think that the answer to that question is, yes, it is the school's responsibility? Because Hope at Last tells me you believe that that's true.
Well, by the school's responsibility, it's a little more broad than that, and in the sense that the school is the one place, the one location where a student does spend a great deal of time, does attend. We require them to go to school until kids are 16 years old in this country. And it's generally looked at as a place of support. We have numerous programs that have developed over time to such as free lunch programs or reduced lunch programs, recognizing that some children's nutritional needs are simply not being met at home. So we have reduced and free lunch programs so that those kids have a chance to gain nutrition necessary for growth and learning and all else. I know that there is a segment in this population that feels that even programs such as those are beyond the scope of what the school should be doing, and I'll have to say that's a perspective I don't share. We have a tradition in our schools of having a school nurse. When you have that many kids together in a setting, young and old, young through old, or young through older in schools, there are obvious medical and health-related issues that are going to come up in schools. A number of kids, if you look at in our society and realize that a quarter of our kids are living in some form of, at some level of poverty or below, a number of, although these services may be changed and reduced in the future, they'll still be, many students will still be receiving some type of support and help from our country. And it seems that oftentimes it's the school is the most appropriate place to mm-hmm. to provide those services. One of the problems that we became quite aware of in this whole arena of interagency collaboration is the tremendous, dramatic duplication of services that exists in serving kids. There will be, we tell a story about a superintendent who at the end of his rope one day over a child misbehaving, said, I want everybody associated with this kid in the room tomorrow, and we're going to all sit down and talk about what the problems are. And at that meeting, there were a dozen people, and there were social workers and probation workers and school counselors and that school counselor and teachers and a parent, and and the list went on. Quite to his amazement, the superintendent's. Out of that meeting, he credits the beginning of what they developed in that small school district, something that's become quite popular in the United States in many areas today, and that's called the use of a case management approach, where various social service agencies, including schools, share information about children that have various connections with these agencies to better serve these students. In that respect, the school seems to be a central place and an appropriate place for that type of, if you will, elimination of duplicative services could take place. And in many schools, it is. I just returned from a conference where I learned a great deal about what are being referred to as full-service schools that are being promoted, have been legislated in certain states that the state of Florida, for instance, has enacted legislation saying just that. We will become full-service schools. We want health services. We want social services. We want it to happen in the school buildings. We want the parents coming there, coming to the school. That'll only help kids.
This is forming a school community, true community, within the school. That's very different. The school seems to be someplace kids go now rather than someplace that connects out into their world.
That's part of the logic behind and why these are working.
Bill Parrott is our guest on this edition of Conversations. William Parrott started at the University of Alaska in 1979 as an assistant professor. He was made full professor in 1990. He served as the head of the department from 1986 to 88. He's been a visiting professor quite a bit during his tenure at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, going away to other schools and bringing back what those schools have to offer to us and taking what we have to offer and what his area of expertise has to offer those schools. His visiting professorships have been five at Japanese universities in the 1980s, also to Manitoba, Canada, to Harbin, China. In Oregon, he worked at the Oregon State University as a visiting professor and as the interim director of the Oregon State University Center for At-Risk Youth in Corvallis. Bill Parrott, our guest, he has a number of edited and written books. The one we're taking a look at today is called Hope at Last for At-Risk Youth. This book takes a look at schools from around the United States. Again, what works, what doesn't work, why, what some of the problems are. Bill Parrott and Robert Barr surveyed the research and took from expertise from all around the nation to put this book together. We're talking today about youth at risk for failure in schools. Why do alternative schools work? Is it again that sense of community and one-on-one?
Those are definitely contributing factors. Alternative schools came about in the late 1960s for a number of reasons. A lot of them came about out of in a very grassroots manner from parents wanting something different for their children. Perhaps if you were to look back over the evolution and development of alternative public schools, you could trace a few themes that have maintained and have been very vital reasons why these schools have continued to be successful. They work. If they didn't work, if the schools didn't graduate kids that were competent and do so on a regular basis, they would have disappeared long ago. In the early days, the alternative schools were often tucked away in distant corners of districts. They were, when you taught and worked in them, and I can remember this quite well, you felt on the edge, so to speak, and definitely not part of the mainstream. A lot of the kids that went to the early alternative schools would today be categorized, we didn't have the term then, but would be categorized as at-risk kids. Kids that were not going to go to school, were not going to continue school, by choice or for whatever reason. They wanted something different. Again, alternate characteristics between alternative schools that have enabled them to remain different are many. One is they're small. They tend to average around 150. Many are less, many are larger, but they don't often go above about 400 students. Mm-hmm. This enables a considerable amount of one-on-one and close relationships to develop between staff and parents and students. So they've developed a reputation of being very personal, friendly, user-friendly situations. Alternative schools offer something distinctively different, typically in terms of a curriculum, in terms of the approach, the teaching style, the level, often the level of formality in the school is different in alternative schools, lower, more casual. That's caused them a lot of criticism over time, but mm-hmm. but in the end, when kids do well, that tends to dissipate the criticism. Alternative schools have focused on development of the whole child, of particularly a lot of the kids in these schools have come with very low self-esteem, and activities often engage kids in developing trust, in building relationships with the staff, with adults. Frankly, a lot of the kids have come with very marginal ability, or very marginal relationships at home and in the world outside of school with mm-hmm. any adults, and these schools have helped to kind of awaken those aspects of a child's nature, of an adolescent's nature, through building trust, through developing successes, enabling a child to reach potential, and so on. High expectations is another characteristic that goes across alternative schools in terms of believing that regardless of where the student comes into school, expectations are held high for that individual to achieve academically and socially while in the school. The out-of-school learning experiences would be one that characterize most alternative schools, opportunities to do work and to be engaged in the real world in meaningful, relevant, work-related, job-related, future education-related situations. A lot of alternative schools will use judges, will use architects, will use uh-huh. botanists in the community to help and volunteer in the school. A great number of volunteers in and out of these schools characterize them. Often alternative schools place high value on, obviously as a part of the individualizing that takes place, high value on maintaining a very close connection with each student. They often spend a day or part of a day of the week, the staff's going over, reviewing students in the school, their progress, and making an effort to stay very much in touch with these students. Interestingly, that's a practice that's now being used in many middle schools, and probably has for a long time in elementary schools in this country, but middle schools, a part of the middle school process or approach, is to bring teams of teachers together and to provide them planning time and work time to really carefully assess kids' progress and not try to cut down on the number of kids that fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. So those characteristics of alternative schools, and there are more, but those are predominant characteristics, have accompanied them over their development of 25 plus years now. There are estimated to be over 20,000 of them in the country today, and it's quite interesting to note that a lot of the reform recommendations for all of public education today, while not coming directly from the experimentation of alternative schools, are the recommendations or practices that alternative schools have been using, particularly with at-risk kids, for a couple decades now.
Which kind of makes sense, because they've been looking most closely mm-hmm. at these students, mm-hmm. not as students who are mm-hmm. extra and problems in their school, but are their
right.
own.
Right.
Yeah. On this edition of Conversations, we're talking with Professor Bill Parrott. We've got a very short time left, about 3 minutes. I do want to ask you about your level of optimism. How steep a hill is there ahead of us in this country when you look at the number of students who are being lost from schools, the number who are not being caught up in alternative schools or community mm-hmm. schools or accelerated mm-hmm. programs mm-hmm. and the various safety nets that are being developed for them.
It would be a cause for either depression or optimism, I suppose. It depends on the individual. We're
and
still
you?
Losing a lot of kids. We have, despite the development of these programs and the acceptance, and I think each year we have more and the opportunities get better, we're still losing a lot of students, and we still have, in many respects, the mainstream of the kids in this country are not being impacted by the development of a lot of programs on the margins and a lot of programs around the edges that catch kids or that help kids. On the other hand, we have come to a place in this society where never before have there been such diverse interests behind supporting public education.
Interesting.
Millions of dollars, millions comes to our schools and has for the last decade from the American workplace, from businesses. That didn't used to happen. It is now because, and probably as important as the donation and the contribution is the reality that businesses now recognize they are part of the whole. They're part of the responsibility, so to speak, of seeing that our kids in this country receive what many regard as a birthright, and that is a free public education and a public education that works. Mm-hmm. So between what we know about schools today and the numbers of these programs that are growing quite rapidly and the influence they're having on slowly, but yet that they are having on public schools, I feel is cause for great optimism. And in fact, it was the driving reason behind why we inserted the word hope in this book. We know how, as one famed author, Asia Hilliard is his name, says quite eloquently, we know how to help these kids today, kids at risk, disadvantaged kids. It's just our decision of whether we will or not. The jury's in on programs, on mm-hmm. strategies. We can teach all kids. We can help all kids learn. It's just a matter of will we decide to do it. And I think we're moving in that direction. I firmly believe that.
Good. Bill Parrott, thank you very much. Dr. William Parrott, our guest on this edition of Conversations. The book, once again, is Hope at Last. It's co-authored by Dr. William Barr and Dr. William Parrott. It's from Allen and Bacon, 1995, mm-hmm. and it's available. This has been a look at at-risk kids. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to thank you for joining us, Bill.
Thank you, Susan.
And I hope you join me again next week.